from WBUR Boston. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The Stuxnet virus hit Iran's nuke program like a cancer, destroyed it from the inside, we're told, sent centrifuges spinning out of control, flummoxed Iranian scientists, frightened computer security pros here at home. Operation Olympic Games was a bold gambit from a president with few qualms about projecting U.S. power, from drones to special forces. This hour on Point, from hackers to commandos, America's secret wars. You can join the conversation. Should the United States government be in the cyber attack business? Is a cyber attack an act of war? Where's this all headed? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now is David Sanger. He's the chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new book, Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David Sanger, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Jackie. Great to be back with you guys.
It is indeed a pleasure to have you here. David, this is getting a lot of buzz, but first, lay it out for us, if you would. What was Olympic Games, and where is it now?
Well, Jackie, Olympic Games was a four-year-long or more American program to use for the first time in American history a cyber weapon against the infrastructure of another state. You know, until now, Jackie, most cyber attacks that you read about have been computers on computers. My laptop attacks your laptop, or an attack against, say, you know, Boeing's industrial secrets, or an ATM network, or stealing passwords from Visa. This was very different. This is computers attacking infrastructure that until now states have only been able to destroy by bombing them from the air or sabotaging them from the ground. And it's a program that began in the Bush administration and was accelerated in the Obama administration after a quiet meeting between President Bush and then President-elect Obama just a few days before the inauguration in 2009, at which President Bush said to the then President-elect, look, there are two programs that you're going to want to continue. And one of them is drones, and the other is Olympic Games. Now, as you said, there's been a lot of news about this. And, of course, there's far more in Confront and Conceal than just Olympic Games. It's about 7 or 8% of the book. The remainder is about Afghanistan and Pakistan, how the presidents responded to the Arab Spring, the fascinating tale of the president's evolution on Pakistan, on China. In this particular case, it's a really interesting story about what happens when America gets a new and secret weapon, not unlike what happened when we first got the atomic bomb or when the Predator first became available or when intercontinental missiles became available during the Eisenhower administration.
Well, indeed, you write that a real Rubicon was crossed here. And I'm sorry, it's a fascinating chapter, Olympic Games. And you take us into the White House and the president's military advisors. And this becomes an incremental proposition for the president. Walk us through what he was learning so that we can learn about what's going on with him, the whole sort of thriller aspect of it, if you will.
Well, from the earliest days of his presidency, the president had to get up to speed on this cyber program that was one of the most compartmentalized in the United States. And so every few weeks, the people who were running Olympic Games would come down into the Situation Room and spread out in front of him a giant schematic diagram of the Natanz nuclear enrichment plant. They called this the horse blanket because it was so big. And they tried to explain, and he got increasingly into the details, how these attacks could get across what's called the air gap. Think of a sort of a giant electronic moat that walled off the Natanz plant from the rest of the world. Like most American companies, they took these sensitive computers and disconnected them from the internet so that nobody could get in.
Mm-hmm.
So that created the first challenge, which is how do you get across the moat? And then once they did that, they had to send in what's called a beacon that would essentially go in and map how the plant is built, how the centrifuges, which spin at supersonic speeds, are connected to these computer controllers. And then beam that information back to the National Security Agency, to Israel's Unit 8200. They were partners in designing this. And then design a cyber weapon. And there were many variants of this weapon. And it was slipped in very slowly and in small ways so that the Iranians at first believed that these machines were simply exploding or going out of control on their own. These were old Pakistani machines. They're pretty unreliable to begin with. So it was an easy thing for the Iranians to conclude that the machines were just breaking down. I compare it to, you know, driving around an old Ford Pinto. You're probably not old enough to remember those, Jackie.
Not at all.
They blew up somewhat spontaneously.
Did they?
What ended up blowing this operation wasn't anything that anybody leaked. It wasn't anything that anybody's written. It was that one day the virus was, or the worm was, ramped up a little too much. Initially, the United States thought this was Israel's work, and inserted into the system. And an Iranian engineer came along and opened up his laptop computer and connected it in, presumably to just do some maintenance work. And the worm leapt aboard his laptop. He probably didn't even know it.
Okay, now let me just pause here. And actually, sure. I was teasing you. I'm old enough to remember duck and cover.
Oh, wow.
So there we are, hiding under my desk at school. When they were trying to get the beacon into the centrifuges, you say that it had to come in on a thumb drive. And I'm wondering, we know that Israel is cooperating with the U.S. here. How many people are in the White House? How they're picking targets? And who puts the thumb drive in the pocket of the Iranian engineer who's walking into the centrifuges?
Well, one of the big mysteries here is, did the Iranian engineers who were walking into the centrifuges even know that the worm was on their thumb drive?
And they don't know.
Well, I think there's probably a mix. My guess, and this is me guessing, but my guess is that there are probably, you know, you can tell from the assassination of Iranian scientists that someone's gotten inside the system. I think there are some people who probably were witting and some people who probably were unwitting.
But it's got an Ocean's 11 quality to it, you say, because this thing is sort of telling the Iranian engineers that everything's okay.
That's right.
And by that, I mean the movie.
Right. If you remember the Ocean's 11 movie, a favorite in our household, there's this great scene where they're breaking into a vault in a, I think it's a Las Vegas casino. And in order to fool the people who are running the control room or watching over the vault electronically, they play back a videotape that basically shows the vault empty. You know, no one in it, nothing happening, while in fact the thieves are getting in and clearing the place out. Well, this worm did very much the same thing. It recorded normal operation of the centrifuges, and then when it began attacking the centrifuges, it played back signals to the control room at Natanz. It said, everything's fine, spinning just the way they're supposed to spin. And then all of a sudden, people would hear explosions going on downstairs. And believe me, you don't want to be standing next to a centrifuge when it's exploding. It is moving at supersonic speeds.
Yeah. You know, the first line of your book tells what happened eventually. It did destroy centrifuges. That's why it was so attractive to U.S. security. But then something went terribly, terribly wrong. The worm escaped.
That's right. The first words of the book are, the worm was loose. And as I said before, an engineer goes down, connects in his laptop, goes home, connects into the internet. And he didn't know that this worm had gotten onto his laptop. And suddenly the worm didn't recognize, because of a programming error, that its environment had changed. It was no longer in Natanz. It was just out on the web like you and me. And it began propagating across the web. And suddenly this showed up in Iran, in Indonesia, in India, eventually in the United States.
Wow.
And people began dissecting it. And you may remember news stories from this time. It was in the summer of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
We ran a very big, long story about this, and my colleagues Bill Broad and John Markoff and I did in January of 2011 with a sort of forensic dissection of this program, which people came to know as Stuxnet. And so, you know, while you're hearing many people run around on Capitol Hill now asking, you know, Are there leaks coming from the administration and so forth? The big break in this story was a technological error.
Well, we'll get to those leaks in the next part of the show.
Right.
But, you know, I just want to ask one thing about this worm. Hasn't it been the fear that someone, as you point out, could detect these codes and then use them back against the U.S.?
Well, that's the big fear about Stuxnet. Once it got out, it basically showed people how to write an extraordinarily complex worm that can attack infrastructure. Now, this one was specifically designed to attack centrifuges in a certain formation. So if it was just on your computer and your computer's not connected to certain kinds of controllers and the controllers aren't connected to certain kinds of centrifuges, it's not going to do anything. It's just going to lie latent. And that was a big deal for President Obama because he wanted to make sure that there was no collateral damage from this. But there was also an effort to try to keep it secret because the concern was that once other countries knew that the United States was conducting cyber war, they would view it as something of a legitimization to go conduct it against the U.S. or other targets, which is why the U.S. said nothing even after Stuxnet came out and even after the Iranians accused the U.S. and Israel of being behind this.
Okay, David, we'll go on with
that on.
All the implications of this secrecy and the program, so just stick with us. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking with New York Times chief Washington correspondent David Sanger about America's top secret wars and where we're headed. With me today is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. I'm the author of a new book, Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, detailing President Obama's tenure at the helm of U.S. national security policy. David, as we were saying just before we went to the break, there has been a lot of complaint on Capitol Hill, the Senate Intelligence Committee, about your articles and leaks. On Tuesday, on the Senate floor, Arizona Senator John McCain accused the White House of speaking to, well, let's see who he mentions, about classified ongoing intelligence operations, and he also called for the appointment of a special prosecutor to dig into the matter.
The author of the article, Mr. David Sanger, clearly states that former and current American officials spoke to him but refused to do so on the record because the program is both highly classified and parts of it are ongoing. I repeat, administration officials discussed a most highly classified operation that is both highly classified and still ongoing.
So what about that, David Sanger? We have you right here. Is the Olympic Games program still ongoing?
Believe that there's no reason to believe that it's not. This is an evolving program. It's taken many forms over the 4 years it's existed so far. And, you know, the Iranians, as I said, got onto it because of the code that got out. They built up new defenses. And, you know, cyber conflict around the world, whether it's trying to update your personal computer against the latest piece of malware that's out there, or whether you're defending a bank, it's a constantly evolving effort. That's why you keep getting those security updates from Microsoft every few weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's no reason to believe that this has ended, but it may well have changed form or targets. To the broader issue here, though, look, you don't produce a book overnight. The emergence of the Stuxnet worm and it the way it became public created a thread to pull on, and it took about 18 months working from the bottom up to try to figure out what this was part of. I looked at this and said, you know, this didn't happen by itself. It just didn't appear. There had to be something behind it. And that's the effort. Now, the book is about far more, of course, than just cyber war and all that. It's a broad look at the national security policy, everything from Arab Spring to how the president handled Mubarak to
and we will drop down on that.
but this is a critical element of it because it fits into the president's light footprint strategy, which is an effort to have a way to deal with adversaries without sending in 100,000 troops, without occupying a country, without having to bomb Iran, without having to invade other countries, without spending $1 trillion.
Yeah, David,
that's where sort of drones and cyber and special forces all meet.
Right. But we've been using drones for longer, I think, than we have these cyber programs.
A bit longer. We've been using drones basically since 2001, 2002. And the cyber program, I put its roots in, its sort of start in 2006, 2007.
Right. Thank you for that. And thousands of drone attacks, of course, and we don't really know exactly how many cyber attacks. But I want to say, with a more conventional war, you talked about light footprint. We know, or we think we know what's coming. You couldn't escape it. We've seen it on TV, listened to it on NPR. But with this sort of attack, it's a fairly small group. I mean, we're talking about war by other means, incrementalism. Doesn't that raise the risk that a very small group, okay, successful with bin Laden, but that a small group could conjure enormous consequences without much national discussion?
That's right. And, people have asked, why did the New York Times write about this? Why am I writing about this in the book? Well, because there are a lot of classified programs that we've had over the years, nuclear weapons, predators, intercontinental missiles, where the program itself and its details can be classified, but there still needs to be a national debate about how you use that weapon. I mean, remember when nuclear weapons came out, it took 20 years before we sort of came to the conclusion that these are too powerful to use. MacArthur wanted to use them in Korea. There were some in the Air Force who argued to Kennedy, the President Kennedy, that he needed to use them during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Eventually, we came to an understanding of how we use them as a deterrent and sort of a weapon of last resort. With drones, it's taken nearly a decade to work out some rules about when and where and how we deploy them and use them. And we're still arguing over those rules and whether this is more like targeted assassination or not. Sooner or later, as a country, we're going to have that same debate about cyber weapons.
Well, and whether or not targeted assassination is an act of war.
Targeted assassination in the case of drones. I mean, you don't target an assassination with cyber. But certainly whether a cyber invasion of another country is an act of war. Now, some people have pointed out since the excerpt appeared in the Times last Friday and since the book has come out, that if you go back to the Pentagon's own description of cyber defense, it is said that a cyber attack on the infrastructure of the United States could well be interpreted as an act of war. That's if it's incoming. Mm-hmm. So then the question comes, well, if that's the case, what do we want to think about our own use of offensive cyber weapons?
Yes, because we maybe did not get into the details of what exactly happened in Natanz. I mean, we don't know. Assassination may not be the word, but we don't know if bodies drop. We do know that since this program began with the Bush administration, that presidents were shown models of melted down centrifuges. Not models,
blown apart models. Yes, yeah. The U.S. I think what you're referring to, Jackie, is I describe in the book how the United States had to test out the cyber weapon just like you test any other weapon.
This is fascinating,
right? And so they built basically a virtual model of the Natanz plant in some of the national laboratories, including the Idaho National Laboratory and elsewhere. They spread it out over several laboratories so people wouldn't sort of put it together that the target here was Iran.
And they got that from AQ Khan.
They got the centrifuges from AQ Khan. I mean, we had a little gift from the Libyans. You may remember that in 2003, Gaddafi decided to give up his nuclear weapons program, which hadn't gone very far. But what he had done was bought some centrifuges from AQ Khan. I've been down to the laboratory in Tennessee and seen some of what they had. Mm-hmm. And these are the same kind of centrifuges that AQ Khan sold to the Iranians. So we had some models of what the Iranians had. And those were, let's say, borrowed from the Tennessee lab for what is euphemistically called destructive testing. And what happened was they set up this model and they attacked it with the cyber attack. It blew apart. And some of the rubble from that was flown to Washington and dropped on the conference room table inside the Situation Room for President Bush to look at. And it was at that moment that he sort of approved going ahead and trying this in Iran.
So how much control and precision does that give presidents when it comes to picking targets? You also write that President Obama, who campaigned on transparency in acts of war, gradually became more and more sophisticated in terms of looking at this horse blanket that you described, these maps, and by all telling, sort of helped to pick or at least was present when targets were chosen.
He certainly I don't think he picked individual centrifuges, but he certainly approved bolder and bolder operations. And it was that escalation of operations in 2010 that ultimately ended up with that escape of the worm that we described before. So, you know, there's always a risk level as you increase the boldness of these attacks that something's going to go wrong, and eventually something did. Now, what's interesting is that even after it did go wrong, he came to the conclusion that the Iranians probably still hadn't figured out fully what was going on, and he approved some additional attacks. And it was one of those additional attacks shortly after the Stuxnet worm got out that brought down a little under 1,000 of the centrifuges.
All right. We're getting a lot of calls for you, David Sanger. So let's go to the phone, 1-800-423-8255. Tony is calling from Exeter, New Hampshire. Welcome to On Point, Tony.
Thank you. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
I have a degree in information technology, and I also have security training through the System Administration and Networking Security Institute. And about 10 years ago, I wrote my dissertation to get that certification through SANS Institute, specifically on this topic of recognizing that more and more infrastructure was being connected to the Internet for remote control access, and that there were not enough security aspects or controls to protect them. And then I recognized that in the years to come, there was going to be this exactly this kind of thing happening. And, things such as the reason being that I recognize that we need to keep our infrastructure such as nuclear power plants, electrical power plants, access to control of dams and railroad tracks and anything you can think of needs to be protected in that way. And and you mentioned earlier, Jackie, that the attacks that supposedly the United States has just committed against Iran opens the door for quote-unquote cyber warfare against us. And I beg to differ. I don't think that had anything to do with it. That door has been wide open for a long, long time already. And this has already been going on for a long, long time. And this is just one incident that became known to the public.
Okay. Thank you, Tony, for that point. But, David, you said that, first of all, maybe we should talk about how computer worms are different from computer viruses. And we're talking about, as Tony did mention, attacks against infrastructure really differing from attacks on computers.
They are, and Tony's absolutely right. I mean, the United States is the most vulnerable country around. Think of, what is it that we don't rely on computers for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So their air traffic control system, our phone system, our cell phone system, our nuclear power plants, we could spend the rest of the show making a list. And some of them are more vulnerable than others. And I think the Obama administration's been working pretty hard to try to seal that up. And they've also even been trying to make efforts within Congress to get legislation passed that would allow them to basically have a greater degree of federal control over the protection of critical infrastructure that's still in private hands to make sure that those somebody can't turn out the lights in L.A. or Boston or something like that. That said, when you're that vulnerable, it then raises the natural question, you're never going to keep a program like Olympic Games secret forever. You may keep it secret for a while, mm-hmm. but does it then increase your vulnerability when it inevitably does become clear that the United States does offense as well as defense?
Let's move into the implications of that, because I'm wondering where the red lines are and whether or not the White House and Pentagon have thought about that, or are they making it up as they go along? Would we, for example, attack a banking system or a hospital? How far do you go?
Well, great question. So President Obama, in the course of the discussions over the Iranian program, raised this issue very frequently and appeared to try to make sure that the worms were designed very specifically at the Natanz plant and that it wouldn't take out the electrical system nearby or the hospitals nearby and have that kind of collateral damage. Now, other countries, other hackers, maybe a mob group, maybe a bunch of teenagers, they may not be operating under the same rules. And so one of the big issues is, do you want to have a treaty? Do you want to have some sets of rules so that people understand what's acceptable or not? Well, that's more difficult in this case because a lot of those who possess or create cyber weapons are not states, and so they don't sign treaties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the nuclear age, you know, it was us. It was the Soviets. Eventually, it was the Chinese, you know, and then Britain and France and so forth. But you had a fairly small universe of the number of people in possession of the weapon. Not the case in cyber.
Let's take a call here from Faraz, who's calling from Melbourne, Florida. Welcome to On Point, Faraz.
Hi, Jackie. I just want to know, I'm from Pakistan. I have a lot of family there, and I want to focus on the drone strikes just for a second here. So obviously yesterday we heard about we got Al-Qaeda's number two, and you know, obviously you know, we could see that drone strikes are effective in some cases, but I mean that it obviously comes with a big mess because prior to that, you know, we had civilians that were killed in a wedding and things like that, and this is becoming more of a big discussion in the mosques, in the coffee houses, in the restaurants. And Pakistan people obviously see some benefit of it, but the consequences are even worse. So my question is, what happens, God forbid, that someone, you know, does that here in America? I mean, it already happened with one person.
Uses a drone or something like that, you're saying?
Exactly. I mean, you know, because, I mean, I know that they were saying that, you know, a lot of hobbyists or even, you know, maybe a simple electrical engineer somewhere can probably come up with something. It doesn't have to be as big and as effective, but what if it even does damage on a small level, maybe kills one person or maybe releases some sort of chemical? I mean, are we ready to deal with the same consequences that have come when someone else uses a drone on us?
Thank you,
you know
for
what I mean?
So yes, thank you for that. David, certainly a legitimate question from someone whose family in Pakistan where there has been a lot of anger over U.S. use of drones. But you mentioned trying to survey this, whether they would have cyber attack stuff or drones. It would be unlikely, wouldn't it, that could Al-Qaeda get its hands on a drone?
You know, they might be able to get one eventually, but, you know, a state might get one earlier than that. You know, a drug cartel might get a hold of one from Mexico and fly it over the border. I mean, sooner or later, monopolies end on weapon systems. You know, the Soviets got the bomb eventually, and then a lot of states that you wouldn't have guessed in 1949 would get them, got them. I mean, North Korea has now. So in the case of cyber weapons, we already know that the Chinese, the Russians are quite advanced. Many other countries have them as well. Not clear whether they can do attacks on infrastructure of the kind we've just been discussing with Iran, but certainly there are repeated attacks in the United States each and every day, each and every hour, to scoop up large amounts of data, maybe to try to take over, you know, certain kinds of computers. So there's a, you know, an active offense and defense operation underway here and has been for a while. The U.S. has always been willing to talk about the risks and the need for defense. It has never before, it's never acknowledged, even after all we've discussed, employing offensive weapons.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the secret fronts of American wars in cyberspace and elsewhere. You can join the conversation. Have you been there, behind the controls of a drone, on patrol in Afghanistan or Iraq? Is cyber war preferable to real war? And with me today is New York Times chief Washington correspondent David Sanger, author of a new book, On the White House, At War. David, we're going to play another clip here. On Tuesday, speaking on the Senate floor in Washington, Arizona Republican Senator John McCain accused the White House of leaking for political reasons and endangering ongoing operations in the process.
They cite leaked classified or highly sensitive information in what appears to be a broader administration effort to paint a portrait of the President of the United States as a strong leader on national security issues.
We have a call on that subject. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Florence, South Carolina. Welcome to On Point, Steve.
Hi, Jackie. How are you today?
Great, thank you. Question?
My question is, I'm surprised that you went back to it, because this came up initially with McCain. Is there a problem with the fact that this is classified information? I would hate like hell to have another special prosecutor when we know the trouble that it causes. Does Mr. Sanger feel reasonably secure that he has not done anything illegal?
All right. Thank you. We'll ask him. David Sanger, what about this? McCain is saying that this was leaked for political reasons. And have you done anything illegal?
Well, I heard what Senator McCain said, and certainly because there have been a number of stories on different topics, from the president's role in the drone area to what I've written here on cyber to other issues, this has become a big issue within Washington. I can only tell you what my experience has been. As I said before, the major tip-off here didn't come from a human being. It came from a programming error that let this program out. Had that not happened, I don't think that this program would necessarily have come into public view. And I started working on that probably more than 18 months ago, and sort of working from the bottom up and working from the code itself to try to figure out how this story all came together. Now, what we've said consistently is, the New York Times, and I've worked there now for 30 years, takes very seriously its responsibility to both raise these public issues, but also not blow ongoing operations, not put people's lives at risk. And so at some point, with any sensitive story, we go to the administration and we say, here's what we have. And if you have security concerns on it, let us know, and we'll take them very seriously. And in this case, there were concerns, almost all of a technical nature, all of a question of how they went about what they went about. And I think I satisfied each one of those concerns. Now, there are some people who read this and don't think any of this should ever be out. The point I'm making is the Iranians already know it.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranians know it because the worm got out.
So, in essence, you vetted some of this with the White House. And I do want to ask, if this is the Obama doctrine, and John McCain is saying that this is political, what about the Romney doctrine? Is there a Romney doctrine that we can identify? And how would it be different if these weapons are already shown to be effective?
You know, I wrote a few weeks ago about the Romney Doctrine and what we could pick out from Governor Romney's public statement so far. It's been a little bit difficult to figure that out because in the course of the primaries, he tended to go pretty far to the right, you know, with some surprising statements, you know, that Russia, the Russian Federation was our biggest geostrategic enemy at one point, he said. At another point, he said that he would sanction China from day one, not the traditional Republican sort of free trade position. But in these areas, I tend to think that no matter who the next American president is, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, whether President Obama is reelected or not, I have a funny feeling that these new remote control devices of trying to avoid having to put American troops on the ground, I think almost any American president is probably going to reach for them. The question is, what rules do they build around their use?
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. Robert is calling from Decorah, Iowa. Welcome to On Point, Robert.
Thank you, Jackie. Yeah, my comment applies both to drones and to cyber warfare. Considered from the aspect of national defense and sort of the history of the buildup of various armaments and so forth, it makes sense and it appears rational. But when you consider the end result, which is no cessation whatsoever to war, and a increased fear among the general public, the Americans and everyone else, as to our future, and to the fact that it is, in fact, both of these are extremely destabilizing, they are both irrational. We live in what Lewis Mumford and Henry Miller both called an air-conditioned nightmare. And the media, just by the very fact that you're talking about it now, you're rationalizing it and talking about it as though it is good, it is just the normal way of doing things. There's no outrage, there's no fear. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment, Robert. But I think the words an air-conditioned nightmare, I mean, what about that, David Sanger? These weapons are out there. They're out there now. How are they? We were talking a little earlier about a treaty. I mean, how are they surveyed? In the old days of missile silos, you could send satellites into space. What do you do now?
That's right. It's very. I mean, obviously, with cyber, it's nothing you can see, and with drones, it's more difficult. You know, I just to your caller's point, we're doing the first thing here that I think the founders wanted a free press to go do, which is just raise the issues so the American public can decide whether or not they want to have rules, outrage, whatever it is. But you got to start from a base of facts. And what we're trying to do here is lay out a base of facts from which you can then work and to do it in a responsible way that, as I said, doesn't impinge on national security if you can possibly reach that compromise. But the second question that comes up is, over the long term, do these weapons make us more or less secure? If your drone attacks in Pakistan generate such hostility in Pakistan that the United States becomes perceived as the enemy rather than the ally, are you getting a short-term gain but a long-term problem?
Mm-hmm.
If your cyber attack against Iran sets the program back a year and a half or so, but makes the mullahs dig in and decide that they really are going to make a political decision to get a weapons capability, and we don't know that that's happened yet, have you set back the program in the short term but sort of made it a permanent feature of Iran in the long term? And these are very difficult questions to ask, and you really can't answer them until you get a little bit further down the line in history.
Well, speaking of getting further down the line, the other thing that really comes out of your book is how much President Obama's thinking appears to have changed. I mean, he campaigned on transparency and one could say was opposed to the notion that we would expand our battle zones. And indeed, now we're engaged in something even deeper than conventional warfare.
Well, that is one way to look at it. There's another way to look at it, Jackie, which is that Olympic Games was designed in part to embrace and bring in the Israelis into a program that would show them that there was a way to slow down Iran's nuclear progress without bombing and thus without providing necessarily the trigger for another war in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the president has evolved. I mean, the Afghan and Pakistan chapters of the book describe a president who came in, as you know, opposed to the Iraq war and committed to getting the United States out, which he's done, but also a president who said that Afghanistan was a war of necessity. And he went through the first year of building up that surge. And as I describe it in the book, almost as soon as he was deciding to do the surge, became concerned that the military would use the surge as a reason to stay in Afghanistan for a 10-year-long counterinsurgency war. In fact, at one point, he sent the Pentagon's plan for counterinsurgency off to the Office of Management and Budget to be priced the way you might cost out a bill in Congress and say, what would this cost? And the answer that came back was, well, sir, hard to say exactly, but for a round number, roughly $1 trillion over 10 years, which was also roughly the cost of providing medical insurance to all uninsured Americans. And so that was sort of his trade-off in this age of austerity. And over time, his view changed, and his view came to be that we had to narrow the goals in Afghanistan, and he came down to three, two of which didn't really have anything to do with Afghanistan. They had everything to do with Pakistan. The goals were dismantle and defeat al-Qaeda. Well, al-Qaeda isn't in Afghanistan by and large. It's in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Try to do everything you can to secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons or make sure they don't go loose. And there's a chapter in the book about 4 days in 2009 when they thought one of them might have gone loose and the Taliban might have gotten a hold of it. Turned out to be a false alarm, but a pretty telling one. And then the last goal was to make sure that the Taliban doesn't retake Kabul. Well, that's the only one that has to do with Afghanistan. But what's gone from that? Educating Afghan girls, building up agriculture in Afghanistan.
But, you know, when you talk about drones, I mean, we have used so many now in Pakistan, and we know that the Pakistanis hate it. The government has passed rules, laws saying they're opposed, the U.S. shouldn't do it anymore. We do it anyway.
That's right. And, you know, I think that's another issue I try to raise in Confront and Conceal, which is we talk a lot about building up a democratic government in Pakistan because the place has been run by and large by the military since its founding 60-some-odd years ago. But as you say, a month and a half ago, the duly elected Democratic Parliament of Pakistan passed legislation to bar all foreign drone strikes. And we've had a lot of drone strikes since, including the very successful one a few days ago that took out the number two in Al-Qaeda. You know, successful in that it has helped dismantle Al-Qaeda, but over the long term, we definitely pay a price for the continued violation of Pakistani sovereignty against the wishes of their elected government.
You know, President Obama campaigned so much on oversight. Is there oversight on the use of drones? We've been talking about cyber attacks, but approving drone targets, especially the frequency with which they are used, and yes, very successful takeout of the number two Al-Qaeda, yes, the other day, but not all these drones have been so precise. What's the oversight process?
Well, the oversight process is supposed to take place in Congress through Armed Services Committee, Intelligence Committee, and so forth. And most of the oversight of classified programs happens behind closed doors because if you do them out in the open, they're no longer classified programs. So the true degree of oversight is a very difficult thing for us to see from the outside.
My guest is David Sanger. We've been talking about his new book, Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. When it comes to things other than the cyber attack, as we promised we'd talk to you about the president's evolution on a number of things in this book, his reaction to Arab Spring, for example, what else – you've been covering Washington for so long, as you point out – what else surprised you about the White House's thinking about where we are now militarily?
Well, two things surprised me about the Arab Spring, which you brought up, Jackie. One was you'll see in the book a bit of the transcript from the last conversation between President Obama and President Mubarak of Egypt. And this mm-hmm. is one of those fascinating moments. It's when Tahrir Square is, you know, alive with the students and the protests. There had been a debate within the White House about whether or not the United States should help push Mubarak out, though he seemed to be going out pretty well on his own. Secretary of State Clinton was very explicit in her warnings that you wouldn't want to push him out until you knew what was going to follow. And, you know, today we've got a lot of doubts about what's going to follow. But in this last conversation, President Mubarak says to President Obama, "You know, sir, give me 10 more days. I can take care of this. I can put this down. I can do what President Nasser did in Egypt, you know, 30 years before." It was code words for give me some time. I'll just kill everybody who's out in the streets and this whole problem will go away. And President Obama, 30 years younger than Mubarak, had to stand up to him and say, "You know, sir, you've been around for a long time. I respect my elders," he said. But he essentially said, "I don't think you understand what's happening in your own country and certainly what's happening on your own streets. And this is over." And it is just one of the most poignant moments in the course of this whole thing. Now, that said, while I think President Obama handled those early days pretty well, the follow-up on the Arab Spring, when I got back out to the Middle East a year after the Arab Spring began, I was in Egypt about a year after the uprisings, the follow-up's been less than impressive. I mean, there's been almost no new money. Congress has not wanted to allocate anything for it. You know, the U.S. has done very little to help support democratization. There's been no equivalent of the Marshall Plan. And we don't live in a standalone world anymore. I went to the Muslim Brotherhood party headquarters, and at the end of my conversation, they said, "You know, Mr. Sanger, it's interesting you're up here in the conference room. You know, we had the Chinese here just a few days ago, and they have some pretty interesting ideas about rebuilding the Suez Canal. You know?
David,
with the amounts of money that the U.S. wouldn't even consider spending.
Well, you know, that gets to my last question. We only have a few seconds for you to discuss it. How do you think history is going to judge how this administration handled its military challenges?
I think that this is going to be viewed as the post-post 9/11 moment, the moment when the United States discovered that we live in a world of limited resources and limited political tolerance for conducting these wars overseas and has to search for a different way. And that's what the light footprint strategy, whether it's drones or cyber or use of special forces, is all about. But we're also running up against the limits of American power. And I know it's tempting in a campaign to say, we have no limits, we can be the old America, we can get out and do everything we always used to do. But the fact of the matter is, we've got a lot of issues going on here at home, and we can't necessarily afford to do everything we used to afford to do, and we have to pick our fights with some care.
David Sanger, thanks so much for joining us. His new book is Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.